Members, we have one bill on our agenda today, Senate File 1611. To get the bill in the form that the author would like it, Senator Pogemiller moves the A3 amendment.
Is this germane to Crookston?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller, could you explain the amendment?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, the Senate Finance Committee has sent us a bill that makes additional investments in pre-K education, in K-12 education by adding 2% and 2% to the formula, and adding about $93 million in higher education. I think it's $53 million in the first year for pre-K. And I think that these strategic investments are crucial to the future of the state in terms of preparing our workforce and allowing us to be competitive in an international economy. With regards to the pre-K spending, I think Senator Clark has pointed out appropriately that the single best investment we can make is in 3- and 4-year-olds, so they'll be prepared to be successful learners. I think Senator Stumpf has made the case that in his first bill, he fixed the leak in the boat by fully funding the special ed cross subsidy so that this 2%, this $300 million, is real money for the school districts. It's no longer acting like we're sending school districts money. This is real money for every school district because they no longer will have it eaten up by flaws in the basic formula. And Senator Pappas, in this bill, is meeting the commitment to hold college tuition down to a reasonable level in both higher in both University of Minnesota and Minsku. And the key point, Mr. Chairman and members, is that you cannot do these if you're going to have an honest, transparent budget. You can't use one-time money to accomplish these purposes. And I think the budget we were confronted with by the governor creates the false promise that one-time spending will solve these crucial investment needs. And so I applaud the courage of Senator Stumpf for authoring a bill that is straightforward and honest about the choices that confront this legislature. To pay for these activities, the bill includes a readjustment to the income tax that asks those who were most benefited by federal and state tax cuts in the last few years to pay to help make these crucial investments. The tax incidence study that we have studied over the last few years, and which Senator Bach had before the committee in the last couple of weeks, clearly indicates, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that chart is in our packet, but it clearly indicates that in terms of fairness of taxation, the group that's being asked to pay an additional amount in this bill is simply not paying their fair share relative to a percent of their income. This bill makes an adjustment, and even under this bill, they will not be paying the same as the middle class. And so I think this is well thought out. There may be some differences on the specifics of the spending. I think this is an honest, straightforward choice put before the legislature to make investments that are crucial to the future of our state in education.
Uh, Members, let's get the A3 amendment on the bill, and then we'll all get a chance to vote on the bill as amended. On the Pogamiller motion on the A3 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The bill is amended.
And Mr. President, I should mention that.
Chairman.
I think, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. Mr. Chairman. Did you say yet?
Yet.
So you were.
You never know.
That may be the news story today.
Never know.
You have aspirations for the presidency?
Has the tax chair ever been the president also in conjunction?
In conjunction. and I'm sure the chair will point this out, but some of the revenue being raised here helps to pay for stabilizing the state-local fiscal relationship with regards to property taxes. And so the components here are investment in education and property tax relief.
Senator Stump.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'd like to just mention that with the changes of the addition of the 2% per year on the formula, there are runs, and I believe those have been handed out. There's a run for 2008, and on those runs, and then one for 2009. On those runs, what we've done, Mr. Nauman and his staff have put together across the full spectrum of both the previous bill that we passed as well as the 2% per year increase in this bill, and what that translates into for education districts across the state. So you can look at that and see that it is a very significant increase. The other piece that I'd like to mention, different from what the bill that you saw before the your committee just last week, is Section 10. And Section 10 was added, it's an assessment, it's really asking the Department of Education to look at the facility needs for all-day kindergarten, and that would come back to this legislature by the first of next year. The reason all-day kindergarten needs some preparation time, basically, is that each district has differing capacity to go into all-day kindergarten. And at some point in the future, we would like to know, those facility needs and how we might assist districts in addressing that. I believe also I think those might have been the only changes from the education perspective. The new overall formula amount for the next biennium would be $5,074, which would be a $100 increase in the formula in 08. And then in 09, it would go up to $5,176, which would be an additional overall, it would be an additional $202 on the formula. So, Mr. Chairman and members, I believe that. Oh, the other thing I wanted to mention is when you saw this proposal before you last week, the Section 1 or 2 of the bill, the Pre-Kindergarten Education Act, had virtually all zeros put into that allowance column, and this spells out the dollar amount for each of those federally adjusted gross income columns. So you'll see that those dollars have been plugged in, so that is a change. And Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions members might have. It's an investment. It's one that moves us forward in the funding of our schools, and also, probably even more importantly, it moves us forward with trying to get Minnesota back on track to be in a very high position in terms of having one of the best education systems in the country.
Questions, members?
Eric.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, can I ask about the allowance? Senator Stumpf, if a parent gets an allowance of $3,800 and transmits the care of the child to someone else, that's a qualified provider, but the qualified provider doesn't charge the entire allowance, what happens to the remainder, and does the parent still qualify for the remainder?
Maybe I can have Senator Clark address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ortman. First of all, I want to say that we've had a number of people working on this bill on both sides of the aisle, so you may have some colleagues you want to talk to about this as well. But what would happen is we are attempting to make sure we're closing the achievement gap and that kids are ready by grade three, that we have, that basically they're meeting those standards. So what we're trying to do in third and fourth grade is focusing on their educational needs. And since
Mr.
most
Chair,
of our system right now.
Excuse me, I asked about the allowance.
And I'm going to answer your question.
Not third and fourth grade. I asked about the operation of the allowance, Senator.
Sorry, 3 and 4 year olds. The way that it would work is that parents, like they can right now with child care, would get the fund. Once they know how much they can be getting, they would contract the provider that they want to use. The provider would go ahead and let the Department of Education know that the parent is using it. If it is a program that currently exists, like Head Start, school readiness, or child care, the funds would be able to be used to expand the number of kids that are used, to extend or increase their capacity. So if the parent was going to Head Start, for example, there would not be an increased cost to the parent. They would just get the services they normally would. If it's child care, the money could be used to help with what the difference may be between what they currently would get in child care assistance and what the market cost was. If it happens to be a child care provider and they're not getting any other funds from the state, they would be responsible still for the remainder. So essentially, it is funds that they can use to help them with meeting the preschool education needs of their child, but it may not cover the entire cost.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, if I'm a parent of a 4-year-old and I want my 4-year-old to go to the Montessori school, and we're going to assume that it qualifies, but the costs are only $2,000 and I fit into the under $10,000 income tax bracket, what happens to the remainder of the $1,800 is my question.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, aside from the fact I don't think any Montessoris would only cost $2,000, under your situation, the Montessori could go ahead and use the remainder to expand services to other kids. Again, thinking about my example that I would use would be Head Start. Right now, Head Start gets funds from the state and the federal government, but they only can serve so many kids. At average, it costs about $7,000 to serve a child. Under this particular strategy, if your child, your 4-year-old, was going to the Head Start Center, you would take your $4,000 and they would take $3,000 out of that pot to essentially pay for your child. What that would do is free up funds where they could expand the number of children that they are serving, or they could extend the hours in the day. Our goal is not to go ahead and be paying over the market rate, though. I mean, if that's what your question is if you're in a market provider, I don't see that happening. We've talked to a number of different providers. If you're talking about actual preschool education, it'd be hard to see that it would actually cost less. The actual cost would be less than $4,000. Right. I mean, part of what we're trying to do here is we're trying to make sure that these programs meet the research elements, which include intensity and duration. So there's a fair amount of what we're expecting out of people. There, and I'm not sure if you've got a situation in which we actually would see the money, you know, essentially being an overcharge. I mean, I can't think of a situation. We've talked to a number of folks, and Montessori, for example, costs significantly more than $4,000.
Senator Ortman, I think it might help if we had Senate counsel explain your question, kind of directly to your question.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just make one more question. If I had a part-time student, which my son was at Montessori, it didn't cost $4,000 a year, but I think if I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong, the benefit doesn't really go to the parent. It gets extended through the parent to the child care provider.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think counsel can help us understand this. Counsel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, if you would turn to page 3. Subdivision 6 refers to reimbursement. So reimburse providers for the allowance on behalf of that recipient. Which it seems they would basically it's my understanding that these costs are usually in excess of what the allowance would be. So this wasn't my situation, although as you mentioned that it's a part-time situation, but they can only be reimbursed for costs already associated with that child.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Council. Does this affect a private daycare? Would they be able to get the money also?
Mr. Chair, Johnson, yes.
So this
as long as they met the requirements.
This is incentivizing our private daycare providers to start a preschool curriculum that they might not otherwise want to go down that path. I mean, they all like to do some type of reading readiness, but this is going to incentivize them to do it and also come under governmental regulation to meet the requirements to get the allowance back?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I believe that is the intent of the allowance.
Senator Clark, is that the intent?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, that is correct. I mean, right now, around the state, who probably could qualify already are accredited child care centers because they are doing those things. Head Starts, there would be many school readiness programs or other school districts. But part of the goal overall has been to make sure that our kids are actually ready and to raise the quality of the place they are. We would not actually be paying, though, for child care, only for the preschool component.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson.
With this private daycare component added to it, it almost seems like the intent is to governmentalize private daycare providers, not and the school readiness, not necessarily help the children be ready for kindergarten.
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I actually think the opposite. What we're trying to do is kind of the approach that Art Rolnick from the Federal Reserve has talked about, where we're making sure that we know from a research standpoint what works out there. We know that you need a certain amount of hours per week. We know that parental involvement is important. We have a pretty good idea of those things. But you want flexibility because different children's needs are, you know, different children have different needs and different programs will do things in different ways. So this isn't starting a new program. It's a funding stream. But we're just trying to make sure that the quality and that we're assessing because we want to make sure that we're getting results is there. So what we have heard from a number of providers is that they want to increase the quality of what they're doing, but the current either funds that parents have or what is offered through our sliding fee program are not sufficient for them to do it. But they would have a lot of flexibility, and it would be optional. Again, they don't have to do this at all if they don't want to be a provider that could accept these allowances.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Clark, I want to, in my personal opinion, is this is bringing government into an area that we haven't gotten to yet. We're getting into the private daycares. We're getting into, and I agree, it will be a choice for the daycare providers whether they want it, but you're giving them a huge incentive to do it, especially if there are more than one child per family, and usually there's two or three. So depending on their income, that daycare provider could get up to, with four kids, $16,000.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, if you think about right now, if you're a licensed child care provider, you are meeting certain criteria. I mean, you have that connection already. Right now, though, we don't expect a whole lot out of providers that are receiving money from the states. And this is, if we're going to invest in our kids, if we're going to actually do the things that pay off, we need to expect something in return. Otherwise, frankly, it's not a very good investment. So if you think about it right now, government resources are in our child care facilities. They're in some of our religious institutions. They are in Head Start. They're in the school programs. And because this isn't a program, it has criteria, though, for the quality piece. We're just simply trying to build on current investments but increase the quality through ensuring that essentially that our kids are going to have at least a floor that's been raised on what we can expect with the dollars.
Senator Johnson, I think I heard you say that, I think you said most families might have two or three kids enrolled in this. I think that might not be accurate. I believe this program is for 3- and 4-year-olds. So, I mean, a family might have a 3- and 4-year-old, but unless they have a set of twins, I don't know, on the range at least, it would be pretty hard to get three kids in a family that are all 3- and 4-year-olds.
Mr. Chair, the potential is there. But I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Clark, I would make the argument that as the daycare providers might, they are already meeting a set of requirements. You're looking for value for the governmental dollar, and they're probably saying, we've already jumped through all of these hoops to get there. For instance, we've put the egress window in the third level. We've done this. We go through the inspections. We've gotten a bigger, better refrigerator that keeps the food colder. They're making the investment. They're meeting the requirements. So now to say, okay, now we want you to do this, I think that we better give them an opportunity to come here and speak, and we might want to slow down this program.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, what you're talking about are physical attributes of a place. Right now in licensure, we're basically making sure that our kids are safe, but not necessarily a whole lot more. And the investment, if we're going to make an investment, if we're going to close that achievement gap, we need to make sure that we are getting out of that the kinds of things that we know will achieve those results. Accredited childcare already in statute gets a bonus in childcare for doing these kinds of things. They already will meet those standards. So we already are incentivizing in statute for the kinds of activities, the kinds of learning experiences that we know makes a difference. It isn't about egress windows. It isn't about the physical plant. That's not going to help get our kids ready.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, as I'm looking at the allowances, apparently this bill does not necessarily target these allowances. And we were having the discussion about added regulations in order to qualify for these funds for preschool. Tell me what these regulations are. What are we going to do to require, what will we expect in requirements from these preschools now that we're going to give them money?
More money. Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, things like making sure there's something called intensity and duration. What the research is showing is that if appropriate activities are happening at about 12 and a half hours a week, for at least 30 weeks in a year, you start seeing that gap close. I mean, that's when the gap closes. If you're only going 2 or 3 days for 2 hours, it's not up to snuff. There are activities that help with pre-literacy. Commissioner Segrin has been working on this. I will tell you that this is very similar to the governor's proposal. We are working with the governor and the governor's staff on this. So for those of you who might be concerned about it, I want you to know this is the bipartisan effort, but since renewable energy. I mean, this is the thing that we've been working on very closely with them. So I just want to make sure you know I'm carrying his bill, and we at this point have been working with his office and with the departments on this. So I think that's important for you to know. We know what's happening with pre-literacy curricula, which is something that the Department of Education has been working with Head Start on. That would be one of the things. We want assessments so that we can see that the child is progressing. We would like parental involvement. Those are the kinds of things that are available right now in things like Head Start and accredited child care and in many of our school readiness programs. So, again, we're trying to build on what we know works and raise the standards.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Clark, is my understanding right, though, that if I currently operate a child care program and I choose to not get certified for this money, I won't lose my license to operate.
Oh, no.
I just won't be eligible for this money. Is that true?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Sarah Moore, yes. You still get, yes, you could still get, right now we have a variety of child care things. For example, I'm married, so this wouldn't apply, but if I wanted to have my boyfriend watching my children, the state would pay for that. That is one of the kinds of providers that's available. Current law. For sliding fee child care. I can use child care, sliding fee child care in a variety of settings. My mother, etc. Many, many families are using family members or neighbors to provide child care, and they may be doing a great job taking care of them, but not providing educational experiences. That would continue just as it is under current law. My hope would be, the example I use, my kids are in college, so it wouldn't count, but if they were still little, if my mother was the one watching them, that we would either work out a way that she would figure out how to meet these requirements, or we would figure out a place in our community that my children would go to, and that's who would get the allowance. So, yes, we are not changing current law, and people could function in just the same way they are now.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senator Pappas is here, and one article that I did not explain was the higher education article.
Maybe before
in that article, there is an amendment that
right. Before we get there, Senator Scoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was going to get to there also, but I just want to say to Senator Clark, as I looked through the bill, it says pre-kindergarten education. It's pre-kindergarten education. This is an education component. This is not a child care component. We're trying to close the achievement gap.
Correct.
With what we're doing here. And child care is child care. But here we're trying to educate these young kids to close the achievement gap. And then, Mr. Chair, if we're ready to move on to the higher ed area.
Senator,
at some
let me
point.
See. Senator Limmer to the early childhood part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Clark, we talk of the achievement gap. I'm not on education committee, so I'm a little in the dark of what achievement gap is. My assessment is, and I've heard figures, that Minnesota students lead the country in ACT and SAT scores. And we must be doing something right. Now we have nearly a half a billion dollar program here that we want to impose. If we're doing so well on the end of our public education, and it's proven by national test scores, my question is, why do we need to spend more money on the front end prior to kindergarten when everyone's complaining that we don't have enough in the K-12 budget? What are we doing? We must not be doing anything wrong as a result of the ACT and SAT scores. So what are we trying to get at with this new additional program?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, and that's an excellent question, and one that we talked a little bit about, I think, last week when we had the other kind of education bill before us. When you look at where we can make gains in trying to reduce our special education costs, which are immense, they're over $1 billion, what the research and all of the information indicates is that if we invest a dollar early on, before the students get to a point of like second or third grade, that we can really change what happens to our long-term costs in special ed. And so we've set standards for math and science, and we're constantly raising those standards up. Where that achievement gap really ends up is that not all the students are getting on board that kind of approach to maximizing their talents and abilities. And so by trying to synchronize what happens in the preschool with what happens in those early years, that's what we're trying to get at. And in the language, it talks about having our early childhood providers kind of understand how children learn how to read, to provide the right kinds of opportunities for children to learn so that when they get to kindergarten and first grade and second grade, they can actually not be behind but move in, into the mainstream of the rest of the students. And Art Brolnick had an article, and I should really have a copy for you, but he was not a believer, and he was challenged by a number of people trying to address this achievement gap or some of those areas. And they asked him, they said, go out and demonstrate why, if this is really beneficial or economically beneficial, and he did. And he said, I'll demonstrate that that's not where we should invest our money, that originally. So he did. He went and some of his colleagues did a financial analysis just straightly based on the economics. And they came back and they said, you know, you're right. I am a believer. For every dollar that we invest in those early years, they get $16 back. Now, it'll vary a little bit depending on, you know, individual circumstances. But he said that that there is no higher return in anything, whether it's there's no other investment that the public can make that gets a higher return than that. And so then he got onto the bandwagon. He's been all over the world talking about trying to invest, make investments in those early years to bring those students who are kind of missing that mainstream back on board. And that's kind of where we'd like to get.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, this might actually help us also transition to Senator Pappas's area. Right now, you know, we are proud of our educational system in Minnesota. We have done wonderful things. But we have changing demographics that are happening. And right now, about 50% of our kids are not ready for kindergarten when they get there. So that's not just low-income kids. It's a variety of other children. And along with the decrease in special ed costs, we also believe we'll see decrease in English language learning, because the children, when they're at 3 or 4, if they've already been learning English, we're going to have a decreased cost when we get to school. If you think about where we're going to be at in 10 years from an aging population, we are going to have a lot more seniors than we are going to have workers. And it's going to be, we're going to need, frankly, every single child that's 3 or 4 years old right now being ready when they get out of school to be productive in the workforce, because we're not replacing ourselves. And so a number of our children have started to have some serious challenges. They're not necessarily, again, low income. But if we want to reduce the cost of special ed and some of our language learning, the disruptions in the classroom, et cetera, closing that gap before they get to kindergarten means everybody is starting fresh, and then we can move from there. So I think that while we may be proud of those ACT and SAT scores, the reality is we've got a whole lot of folks that aren't there. And we want to be competitive in the global marketplace. We want to be leaders. And the way that we've been leaders in the past has been through education. But if we're serious, we need to get down to business. We're way behind other states right now, like Oklahoma, Alabama, Georgia, West Virginia. Those are not states that I'm used to comparing us with. But if we take this simple step forward, I think the kinds of things that Senator Stumpf was talking about can help us make sure that we're not doing remediation by the time they get to college.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions. First, I'm wondering if there's a fiscal note that would show us how much this actually costs. I know how much the income taxes will raise. I'm wondering how it gets distributed through this program, how much the cost is in terms of tails and things like that. It's important for us to know. And then if this really is an educational bill, if the purpose here is education and not child care, as Senator Skoy has said, then I think that some fundamental amendments would be appropriate, because the provider certification on page 4 sets it up so that the Department of Human Services is certifying child care programs.
And Mr. Chair,
and I was not done.
Okay, go ahead.
And it says that throughout that provider certification section. And the conversation we've been having is not just about education. It's about child care. And I know that that's not the purpose, but I think that the bill needs to be amended if the real purpose here is just education. Because the Department of Human Services really doesn't have a whole lot of qualification for certifying educational and academic programs. And it shouldn't be optional, one department or the other. My understanding is that the Department of Human Services didn't testify about this bill, and they've talked about the mechanics, the departments, but not the policy here. And I know that this committee wants to roll this bill out and maybe steamroll it through the Senate, but I think maybe it warrants a few more minutes of testimony before we go on. I think this has a huge impact on Minnesotans and our future. And I think that we should give it the time that is warranted and certainly opportunity for the public to be heard.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Stump has a run of the three different spending areas of the bill.
Mr. Chairman and members and Senator Ortman, there is a one sheet. I think it should be in your packet. And this does have the different costs that go into the program. And if I could just real quickly just step you through that. The Department of Education, do you have that sheet, Mr. Chairman?
No.
Okay, then.
Sir Stump, we're going to make some copies of it. So
then maybe I should.
Why don't we wait until members have copies?
Maybe have Senator Pappas talk about the higher education.
Senator, is that okay? We'll get copies before we kind of get into your point. But I think that's a good point, Senator.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask a quick question before we leave this one? And maybe just by virtue of example, my own daughter happens to be a stay-at-home mom, although my granddaughter, is now in all-day kindergarten. But at the age of 3 and 4, if she were to have become certified, if you will, gone through the process, could a stay-at-home mom avail themselves to the allowance provided that they're certified and do the program, or is it just for those that go to a daycare?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sundjum, ironically, Senator Berglund's bill just eliminated the at-home infant child care program that had a similar concept in it. The thought in this, though, is that you would actually be using something outside your own home.
Okay, so you'd have to send your child to a daycare, okay.
I don't think it's precluded, though, and one of the things you should note is because we would not actually be rolling this out until next year, there's going to be a stakeholder group that would be working both with education and with the Department of Human Services to look at some of the mechanics. Personally, I'm not sure that would be inappropriate, but it's something we'd probably want to look at. And I do just want to make one comment back to Senator Ortman's question. Today's child care is basically where most people get their preschool today. And if the child care provider, whether it's a family or it's a center-based center, if they're providing a preschool experience, it's absolutely appropriate for this money to go there. Not to be paying for the rest of it, but to be paying for that piece. I know that our own children, because there's no way we could have been driving our kids all over the place, we found a child care center that had degreed teachers that did appropriate curricula, and that's where they went and did preschool. So we want to make sure that parents have good choices, but we're only going to go ahead and be paying for the components that are educationally related.
Senator Stump, before we go to Senator Pappas, we have an A5 amendment. We probably should get on.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A5 amendment. The appropriations section for higher ed got left out of this provision, and this just puts the appropriation language in.
Members, on the A5 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A5 is adopted. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My original higher ed bill, my target was $296 million. Throughout we've done over the last few years, where really 91% of that was balanced on the back of with rising tuition. And so the attempt here with an additional $93 million is really to hold down tuition. And I do that by providing an additional $27 million to MNSTU and you, and then another $24 million to MNSTU specifically to hold tuition to 3%. And then we also make an adjustment in financial aid, because we're recognizing that we need to do some more work in financial aid in terms of getting into the above around $60,000 income that don't qualify for most financial aid programs, but that are struggling to pay.
If you look at page 11,
I do actually have language on 1120 that says the legislature intends that the board of tuition will not increase tuition more than 3%. And because the two-year colleges in particular are among the highest in tuition in the country, they're in the top five, they actually did put some language in urging the board of trustees to even increase tuition less with the two-year colleges, less than 3%. On page 12, line 8 through 11 is where we encourage the board of regents to do not exceed 5% increase in each biennium. And when my bill came out of committee, finance committee, they told us that at their rate, $136 million additional dollars, their tuition increase would be 5.5% in the first year and 7.5% in the second year. So we're hoping with this additional money that we can keep that at 5%. And then section 5 is where we change the assigned student responsibility. We drop that a percent from 46 to 45 percent, and that costs us $14.6 million. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the higher ed section of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman and members, I believe that spreadsheet for the overall bill, the education part of it is handed out. And if I could just quickly step through it, the formula allowance increase is at the top, and as you'll notice, the very top line. Next, or 08, the formula will be 5,074, 09, 5,176, and the increase is $100 the first year and $102, and members, I said $202 increase, but that's over the original base, so if you can imagine kind of a stair step, you increase the base $100 the first year, the second year, you increase it again by $102, so really the second year it's over the original base, it's like $202. On line 3, it has the cost of those formula increases, $93.4 million the first year. In 09, it's $199.2, and then you'll see the out years, 2010 and 11, the cost of $292 and $209. The reason that there is a difference there, again, we have a 90-10 payment split, so not all of it is there. When we raise the formula amount, we also have other things that happen, and that's line 4 through line 6. We have an increase in the non-public pupil aid, and we'll have an increase in non-public pupil transportation aid, and tribal contract schools will have an increase. And then lines 7 and 8 are the pre-kindergarten education allowances. And as you'll notice there, the first one is $53.8 million in 09. And the way that would function, according to the language in the bill, is that about a year from now, the allowances would be calculated through the information from the Department of Revenue and sent out through the Department of Education. And then those allowances would be allowed or be able to be used by fall of 2008. then the tails of that cost, as you can see, go up in the 2010 and 11. The line 8 is the administrative costs for the Department of Education, and then line 15 is the administrative costs for the Department of Health and Human Services. And then on lines 21 and 22 are the costs, or the increased appropriations for the MinSCU system and the University of Minnesota. And line 23 is the increased appropriation for the Office of Higher Education, which is our state financial aid system. And then at the bottom, you'll see the increase, the total, grand total. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the changes in this education funding bill.
Any other questions, members? Sir, let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if we're done with the spreadsheet, I was going to move on to the higher ed provision a little bit.
What, I'm sorry, I do have a question.
Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, I can't figure out how to reconcile line 7 and line 15.
Line 7 is the cost of the allowances that go out to the parents of eligible children. Line 15, did you say?
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, line 15, the Department of Health or Department of Human Services is involved with the they have a hand in the administration part of the overall program, in the sense that let's see, on I believe on page 2 you'll see language in subdivision 3. First of all, the Department of Revenue will be the gatherer of who is eligible in terms of how much, and that refers back to subdivision 2, which is that federally adjusted gross income. Then the that information is transmitted to the Department of Education. And the Department of Education and the Department of Health and Human Services are the ones that would be have the responsibility of designating the eligible providers. And so the administration costs for those two departments, basically for those two departments are reflected in the lines 8 for the Department of Education, and line 15 for the Department of Health or Human Services.
I hate to see Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, line 15 is the administration costs to hand out $195 million.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, the administration costs would probably be more closely associated with designating who the eligible providers are. The as you can see there, the Department of Education has a higher administrative cost than the Department of Human Services. The Department of Education has greater responsibility in that they have to notify, they have the responsibility of actually sending out these allowances or notices to the parents, whereas the Department of Human Services will be working with the Department of Education to designate which providers are eligible. I hope that wasn't too confusing.
No, Mr. Chair and Senator Stump, it wasn't confusing at all. My concern is in 010 and 011, it's $195 million. And I'm sorry, I'll make the argument. I'd like to see that in the K-12 budget.
Ms. Coy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Pappas, I listened to your discussion about the tuition for MinSCU and the U, and I certainly am supportive of the funding for those institutions. They are extremely important for our state. You know, as we work to keep tuition down, you know, what drives the interest in the tuition reductions is the debt that students carry when they graduate, because it's becoming to the amount of debt that these kids are carrying is really restricting access, I believe, to higher education. And the way that, you know, the bill that I introduced and we heard in committee addressed the debt was to reduce the student share. And I see here on line 20 of page 11, you do make a 1% reduction to student share. I do appreciate that. But, you know, when we want to reduce debt for kids, that student share, that's the percentage that they're responsible for before they qualify for a state grant, and that's the part that they end up borrowing. So if we're interested in reducing debt for kids, we need to be attacking that. And we did make a small step here. The bill that I had would have reduced that to 40%. I do appreciate the movement that we see here and would hope that as this bill moves forward, you would continue to look at that as an important component. And thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Coy brings up a really important point, and we do need to take a serious look at our financial aid program. And I have asked in my other bill, the Office of Higher Education, to do that so we can come back in next year. As Senator Polgemiller says, we have a four-year term. We can't solve all our problems in the first year. But we need to take a more thoughtful look at that so that our state grant program in particular, we are raising the caps so that more families are eligible. We move it up more into the middle class. I think that's very important. We're among the top in the nation in terms of our student debt load. And in addition, I just got a report from the university yesterday that students are now carrying two-thirds of the cost, instructional cost, with the state bearing the cost for only one-third. And that's a reversal of where we were 7 years ago, where the state was still funding two-thirds of the cost. So we have definitely fallen down in our commitment to students in both areas, the financial aid program and in funding institutions.
And Mr. Chair?
But we made some progress in this bill. Yep. All is not lost.
And Senator Coy. Senator Pappas, I appreciate your efforts, and I appreciate your recognition of that as an important issue. And you know, if we had more resources, I'm sure we would be attacking this, and we will be working on this in the future.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Pappas, if I heard you right, you said that this is a good start, and so I'm anticipating there will be more government programs like this. And who are we going to tax next time? We're taxing the upper bracket income taxpayer. What plans do you have for the Minnesota taxpayer next year as you expand more programs? I'm only thinking that what you said is there's more programs to come. Where are we going to get more revenue to do this type of thing?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Senator Limmer, government programs like this is our higher education system. You said that so disdainfully. This is where the future workforce is coming from. This is what's going to sustain our economy in the future. This is vitally important. This isn't something to denigrate. Our higher education system and our private colleges are all very important to our future. I personally think that we should put more money into higher education. This is much as I was able to get, and I'm hoping to convince the tax committee today for another $93 million. But I can't say anymore. I'm just shocked that you would be so disrespectful.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, the finance packages that we've been considering in the last few weeks by your party, majority party in the Senate, have put together proposals that are 300 and 400% higher than the governor's proposals. That's quite a bit different as we look at these proposals. And I think it's a very prudent question to ask, where is the money coming from? And if there's a hint that this isn't enough, as you said this today, where are we going to get the money next year and the next year? We have a four-year term. If there's more government programs, it might be wise to look at more of a global plan of just what your plans are. I don't think that's disdainful at all. That's the responsible thing to do is to ask, where do we get the revenue to do all that you want? That's not disdainful. And when that question becomes disdainful, we better start analyzing what we're doing here.
Mr. Chairman, I think that was a rhetorical question.
Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, this might be for staff or even for Senator Pogemiller, the mastermind here. I'm looking at the fiscal note or the run on the individual income tax, and it looks like the new proposal with the new brackets raises about $1 billion in this biennium and $1 billion in the next biennium, but the spreadsheet that I got for the education supplement for 2008-09 only shows spending of $444 million for the first biennium, so that leaves about $500 million on the bottom line, and I'm sure that it's being spent. I'd just like to know where.
Senator Ortman, in order for us to stay in budgetary balance, we end up raising more money in 08-09 than we need because we only do property tax relief in 1 year. We can't do property tax relief in 08. We can only do it in 09. So what we end up doing is carrying money forward from 08-09 in order to provide for 2 years of property tax relief in 10 and 11. So that's kind of the short answer, I guess, is there is a carry forward from the 8-09 biennium into 10 and 11, and you see how the cost of Senator Stump's bill goes up in 10 and 11 from 433 to 735.
Sure does, yeah.
So most of the income tax that's raised in 10 and 11 does go to education, but some of the income tax raised in 08-09 gets rolled into 10 and 11 so that we can pay for 2 years of property tax relief in 10 and 11 while we only pay for 1 year in 8 and 9. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, is that carry over the 600 or 500 million that
I think it's slightly less than that, Senator Ortman, but we will have a handout on the floor tomorrow, and I'll try to make it available to you today that shows how Senator Stump's bill and the tax bill interact together, because we all remember when we passed the tax bill out of here, it wasn't totally paid for. So there is going to be a spreadsheet that shows how the tax bill and Senator Stump's bill go together that will then show how much is rolled over into 10 and 11 to make sure that in both bienniums we're in balance. Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman, in the first education bill, we had roughly $110 million in permanent property tax reductions. And this spreadsheet here does not show that.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogemiller.
Chairman, Senator Ortman, the other piece here is there's been an insistence on having biennial structural balance. And Senator Bach has designed his bill to make sure there's biennial structural balance, because it would not be honest or straightforward to not have structural balance. And our fear is that the governor's budget was not structurally balanced, and we need to correct that.
Senator Ortman, the new spreadsheet will show that the Senate's budget is in balance through 2011. Unfortunately, after the February forecast, even the governor will tell you that his is not. Inflation is not paid for in the next biennium. And that's not a criticism of the governor. That's just what happened when we lost $400 million in the February forecast. And I think it's likely the House budget that we see will be similar to the governor's in that it will not be balanced in 10 and 11. And I, as the tax chair, feel a great responsibility that we make sure that the commitments that we make in the biennium that we're here in, that we can pay for the balance of our term in 10 and 11. So, Senator Ortman, for that reason, we have to raise a little bit of additional money in 08-09 and make sure that we have enough to carry the tails, because you see what happens to Senator Stump's proposal in 10 and 11. So if we're going to be fiscally responsible here, we have to raise a little bit more in 8 and 9 and then spend it in 10 and 11. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the fact that you're balanced over two bienniums. I mean, I do think that's the right thing to do so we can look at the whole picture. I don't agree with the whole picture, but at least you're presenting a complete picture in pieces, but we'll have it all together tomorrow, and I really do appreciate that. I know that's hard to do. My question about that is, if we're raising more in this biennium than we need in order to pay for the tails going into the next biennium, will that money also sit in the bank account like the reserve, and do then we need the $629 million in reserve to bring the total up to 5.1? Can't the taxpayers at least be given the credit of the fact that we've got money in the reserve, we've got money that we're raising in this biennium that we don't need until the next biennium? Aren't we just maybe imposing a little more even than you need to do this?
Senator Ortman, the intent of the reserve is to cushion, provide, our budget is in balance. I mean, when the new spreadsheet comes out that shows how Senator Stump's bill reacts with the tax bill we passed yesterday and the rest of the budget, we will have about $4 million on the bottom line over a four-year period. So inflation will be paid for in 10 and 11. We'll have about $4 million left, and we will have put $629 million into the reserve, getting us up to where the Council of Economic Advisors suggest we be, because we don't know what's going to happen this coming November or next February, and we'd be shaving it too close, and I don't think we'd be fiscally responsible if we just said, well, we don't need to have 5% in the budget reserve. Having a little money on the bottom line is enough.
Senator Mr. Chairman, I think the point Senator Ortman's getting at, though, is there is some one-time money available in the earlier year, and you're using that, as I understand it, in your bill to buy back one of the shifts partially?
And Senator Ortman, when I have that spreadsheet, it will show that, and I think it might be helpful if we handed that spreadsheet out on the floor tomorrow.
Which shift are we talking about?
So members can see some of the money, Senator Ortman, is being rolled forward to cover Senator Stump's increased spending, to cover the tails in 10 and 11. Some of the money that we raise in 09 is going to roll forward and be used to buy back some of the June accelerated sales tax shift. So I think the business community will be really pleased about that. Last year I heard the governor's staff say that when we can buy back June accelerated shift, that's tax relief for business. So we're going to roll some of the money forward, Senator Ortman, to make sure we cover the spending and keep the budget in balance, and we're going to use some of that one-time extra money that we raise in this biennium to buy back the June accelerated shift and provide some tax relief for business.
So what, Mr. Chairman, what percent do you think you're going to be able to hit there?
I think, Mr. Chairman, we're currently, or Senator Pogomar, I think we're at about 78 percent in the shift, and we're going down to 30% in the shift. So it's a significant use of some one-time money to provide some tax relief for business.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Will there be any opportunity for the public to testify about what these new provisions this morning?
Once we've concluded our discussion and don't have any other questions of the author, I'd be more than willing to open it up to the public. Senator Pogomar, can we move session back a little bit if we have some public testimony, people want an opportunity to comment on the bill? Senator, I think we can accommodate that.
But Mr. Chair, with all due respect, one of my concerns is that we've just offered major amendments to the direction of our state. Nobody had any notice, not even me. I didn't know we were going to look at these things today. I mean, I knew that we were going to have an income tax increase, but I certainly didn't know about Senator Clark's allowances and Senator Pappas's money for higher ed, and I appreciate their work. But I think the public has a right to know what we're considering and to come and testify. And if they've never been given notice, how can they do that? Now, I know you have to pass your budget bills, and I know you're in charge, and it's not easy to be in charge and get your work done on time. But with all due respect, these are huge changes in the direction of our state, and more notice should have been given to the public. And if we have to come back and have hearings on this after the Easter break, then I think we should do that and make sure people have a chance to come tell us what they think, email us and phone call us and all of those things, because I think that it's a fundamental flaw around here that we haven't invited them to participate this way.
Well, Senator Ortman, this bill of Senator Stump's, this additional spending on education, was passed out of the Finance Committee yesterday morning. I think it's been well covered by the media, and they had to send it here so that we then could find a way to pay for it. So I'd be happy to have members of the public testify. I mean, I don't think it was much of a secret this bill was coming here. I've been reading about it in the paper for 2 or 3 days at least. Senator Stump?
Mr. Chairman, this actually was the same language that we had in the first education bill, which worked its way out of division and I believe out of the policy committee. Anyway, it worked its way through the system, the finance committee, and then the tax committee a couple weeks ago, or whenever the first part of the education bill. And then it was the tax committee that took out the language, and then it, again, it came through the same system.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogler.
Chairman, we certainly could consider waiting until Monday to vote on this on the floor, if that would work for Senator Ortman. But I get the impression that most members understand what's here and would like to process this.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, what I've suggested is maybe having a hearing about these provisions after the Easter break. I don't think we need to delay the vote. I think everybody's going to know how they're going to vote on this.
Right.
But the published agenda for today for the tax committee said Senate File 1611 Stump. It was the Crookston Sales and Use Tax Imposition and Bonding Authority. How could they possibly have known that we were going to talk about disincentives for stay-at-home moms today? Did they know that? Did they know that we were going to give allowances to parents that transfer their children to child care centers and preschool programs, but not to parents that raise their own children at home? Did they know we were going to do that today? I don't think so.
Well, Senator Ortman, I think it was pretty well reported in the newspaper and on the news. I watched it on the news last night that Senator Stump's bill was passed out of finance yesterday and sent to the tax committee. I think a whole lot of more people watch the news or read the newspaper than follow the Senate's internal email postings. But I just don't think this is being sprung on anybody. And Senator Ortman, I'd be happy to to have another hearing and discuss this bill after Easter. And we want to provide some additional public comment. I mean, I don't know what the point is after the Senate's passed it, but we certainly could do that. And I'm certainly willing to take some public testimony today from people that are here. And I'm sure there's people here that would like to comment on it. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say that in the Higher Ed Committee, we had lots of hearings and discussion about the problem with tuition and student debt. So this really is in response to public testimony and a concern that was expressed to our committee.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I absolutely concede that point, because this is just more money for the things that you discussed in your committee. But the early childhood stuff is definitely new, was not expected to be brought up today. We knew that there were going to be income tax increases, but we didn't know about a fourth tier. We didn't know about, $2 billion over the next 4 years. And I would think that the public might have some comment about that.
Well, Senator Ortman, I made it, I think, real clear to the members of the tax committee when we passed the tax bill out that it wasn't paid for, it wasn't imbalanced, and we discussed that. And we discussed the fact that at some point here we're going to have to pay for the additional spending on property tax relief in the tax bill. Now, there's no question it was probably pretty easy for the finance committee, to send Senator Stump's bill here. It's real easy we all can I think, support additional spending for tuition and early childhood and for money on the formula for schools, but then somebody has to do the heavy lifting, and that's where and this is the committee that has to do it. I think we all know that. That's why we're sitting here, and if we're going to spend the money, we have to raise it. So I don't know what more to say other than that. I don't think it's been a secret to anybody. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a comment on the pre-kindergarten education allowances. I do sit on the education committee, and this is the first I've seen, and I really don't want to spend $195 million in pre-K. I agree with Senator Pappas, and I'm surprised that she's not putting up more of a fight over the money from Senator Clark. But I just can't support a bill that looks like this, and that's my input on the heavy lifting. I can't support this.
Get out of the weeds, Senator. Testimony?
Who wants to move?
I would move the bill, but I think you want to do testimony.
Thank you to our cast at the table.
I do move the bill.
Senator Pogemiller moves that Senate File 1611, as amended, be recommended to pass. Public testimony. Mr. Kramer, welcome to the committee. Please give your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Joel Kramer. I'm the Executive Director of Growth and Justice, which is an economic think tank dealing with Minnesota state policy. And I just want to speak briefly to the income tax part of this bill. And I think it's very well crafted. I didn't see it until half an hour ago, so I don't know exactly all the details of it. But generally speaking, I just want to say that raising revenue by creating a new top-tier bracket is the best way for the state to raise revenue, and I want to just make 3 points about why that's true. Number one, there is no evidence that a high rank on the income tax impedes economic growth, despite the fact that many people keep making the argument that it does. Both in comparing all the states in the nation, the evidence is clear that there's no correlation between having a high top rate and economic growth. And in Minnesota's own experience, we did much better relative to the nation economically in periods when we had higher rates and have dramatically declined since. Now, I am not saying that we have declined because our rates have come down. We're declining because we're not investing and in things like education, transportation. But there is no negative to having the high rates in the evidence that goes back decades in comparing all the states and Minnesota's experience. Number two, this new top bracket enables the state to capture the dollars mostly from the 1% of Minnesota taxpayers who are paying far less than their proportional share of all the state and local taxes. Even with this bill, they would still be paying less than their proportional share of all the state and local taxes. And finally, incomes at the top among these 1%, a few percentage points are affected by this revenue bill, but most of the money comes from the top 1%. Incomes in that top group are rising very rapidly. It's another way of saying there's increasing income inequality, both in Minnesota and the nation, and recent reports show that it's actually accelerating. It's very, very substantial. So a new top bracket like this raises the tax on the fastest growing income in the state, and that will increase the state's ability to have a revenue system that keeps up with economic growth. And if we do not have this change, right now we have a revenue system in Minnesota that is not keeping up with growth. What I mean by that is if you just leave the tax system as it is, the projection is a decline in the price of government, which is the amount of government relative to people's income. So if you want a stable system that grows revenue at the same rate as economic growth, then you want to capture it where it's growing the fastest, which is in the top 1%. So I think those are all arguments in favor of having the fourth tier. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
I sit here thinking of my dear former seatmate, Senator Kurland, who I just respect just profusely. And over the course of last 4 years when he was with me and with the rest of us in the Senate, he didn't speak frequently. But when he did speak, he, and on several occasions at least, he would offer that we need to be very, very careful about taxing the top of our income people. And certainly not for personal reasons. Senator Curlin himself, very supportive of higher education, very supportive of education, very willing himself to pay. But he would often caution us about the need to think about our high achievers and think about our job creators and think about those entrepreneurs that are going to lead our state through their innovations and minds and creativity on into the future. And he would caution me personally as I would talk to him, and would occasionally caution the clinic, or pardon me, the Senate rather, that we need to be terribly careful about chasing those people out of Minnesota, to giving those people not the kind of environment that, at least from the standpoint of taxes, that they might find in other states, and that. You know, that just lives on with me, and I can't help but offer that up today as I listen to this testimony because, again, I think of that man and what he personally has achieved in his life, his perspectives on business, and I think they are profound, and I think we have to remember those as we go forward here.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, question for the testifier. I know that the income taxes are probably the most progressive way to raise revenue to pay for state expenditures, and I'm sure you agree with that. That comes from basic economic study. But my concern is that when we continue to ask the private sector to pay for more public sector activity, it's not sustainable. And I'm wondering if you can address that, because we put more and more burden on the private sector. There's more and more public sector growth. How are we going to generate the revenues to support all that public sector spending?
Yeah. Well, I think the facts are that relative to the size of the economy, and that's always the way to measure expenses in the same way that, you know, you would say the price of a car you buy. You don't talk about the absolute dollars today compared to 40 years ago. It's relative to earnings. Relative to the size of the economy in Minnesota, it is not true that we are spending more. We're spending less than we used to. We have a lower price of government than we did in the 90s by a substantial amount, billions of dollars a year, less government relative to the total income of the state. And even if you don't want to use that measure, we think that's the best measure. It was originally proposed as a measure to the state by the Chamber of Commerce 15 or 18 years ago. If you don't want to use that measure and just prefer to use how much government do we have relative to, per capita, real per capita, relative to just inflation and population growth, the general fund is substantially smaller than it was 4 and 6 years ago. So I don't accept the premise that we are putting more burden on the private sector. What has happened is we dramatically reduced the amount of government, and now there is a correction going the other way because of the dramatic amount of reduction of money being devoted to government relative to the size of the economy.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, but the number of jobs in the government sector continues to grow and outpaces the private sector in terms of the growth. Isn't that true?
Absolutely not.
Mr. Kramer?
Right now, we're not doing very well in the private sector. We were doing a lot better in the 90s. We actually were a top performer in the nation in private sector growth and in personal income growth in the 90s relative to the nation. Obviously, it was more of a boom time, but relative to the nation, we were doing very well. We cut the taxes dramatically 6 years ago approximately in a period of cuts over years. And this year, we were 46th in the nation in growing the private sector. So we agree that it's very important to grow the private sector. What we disagree on is whether more government spending dampens or increases the ability to grow the private sector.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I think we're close to agreement, though. The dollar that's generated by the private sector is worth more in the economy than the dollar spent through the public sector.
No, I don't agree with that. The money spent investing in education and transportation and infrastructure and health care has a tremendous return, and the evidence is that return to the economic growth. We're using the same measure, growing the economy. The return of public spending is just as high as the return of private spending to creating economic growth.
Mr. Chair, however, I didn't ask about the return. But every time you spend a dollar in the private, in the public sector, you have to pay administrative costs that aren't necessarily spent in the private sector.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand that point. There's administrative costs in both government and business. I'm not sure I understand what that
is. Mr. Chair,
Senator Dibble.
Without getting into a great philosophical discussion, I think we had this conversation a few days ago when The Economist was presenting to us, and I think the point he made is the point that Mr. Kramer is making, that is it is simply untrue to say that money spent privately is more effective or more efficient or more beneficial than money spent publicly. It depends on what you're spending it on. I think the point that Mr. Kramer just made is on those sorts of things that we can't do individually that we have to do together, like education, like transportation, some of those basic infrastructure things that then allow us to thrive and succeed as individuals, as businesses. That's where you get the benefit in spending public money.
Yeah, if I could just add one point to that. If there's money being spent on a public purpose, as, for example, in today's bill on pre-K education, I'm agnostic on the question of whether it's spent by the public in the way we do K-12 or whether it's spent by passing the money through to people who do not have the money to create demand. And in this case, they may spend the money in the private sector. But that is a public purpose spending. And whether it's spent by the public or spent through the private sector, it is beneficial to the economy because public purpose spending creates human capital.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
But the money to pay for the public purpose spending has to come from the private sector because the government doesn't generate revenues.
Absolutely.
And so as the private sector continues to get smaller relative to the public sector, it's not sustainable. And that's our big argument right here. If I could finish, Senator Dibble, if you increase the income taxes, that money, which would be invested in the private sector, no longer can be invested in the private sector because you're going to pay for public purpose. Isn't that true?
Of course, every dollar can only be spent once, but public purpose spending creates economic growth. That's what I'm saying.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Mr. Kramer just made the point I was going to make. It's a false premise to say that the private sector will automatically decline relative to the public sector if you increase public spending, create more economic activity. The economic picture expands overall.
Mr. Chair, is it then true that you really indeed can? Because I often say you can't, but you can spend your way to prosperity. We're getting kind of philosophical now.
Well, Senator Senjum, making strategic investments in both private goods and public goods does lead to prosperity. That's a fact. And the history of Minnesota is overwhelming on this. The legislators who sat in these seats 30 and 40 years ago who made the decision to invest in education led to the 1960s and 70s where Minnesota income growth outpaced the rest of the country. Our history tells us that strategic investments in education make a difference. And that's where Senator Stumpf and Pappas and Senator Clark are headed today. We simply need to make this judgment now for the next generation. It's the right thing to do.
And, Mr. Chair, we will forever look for that break point and I guess that's why we're here.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, I don't disagree that this would be good spending. I don't disagree with that at all. But it's not sustainable by the people that generate the revenues to pay for it. That's my big concern. And so in a perfect world, this is a great deal. But for the people that have to work hard to generate the income, they're not going to have as much opportunity to generate that income anymore. That's my biggest concern, is that the people that work hard to actually raise the revenues that the government feeds off of have less ability with this bill, the $1 billion tax increase each biennium, they have less ability to generate revenue. And that's a terrible problem for our state and with this budget.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Ortman, absolutely not what you just described. The truth of the matter is when you move people out of poverty into the middle class, and when you move people from the middle class to higher incomes, you generate more economic output and more availability for economic growth in your state. That's what the legislators of 30 and 40 years ago showed us. Because Minnesota did lead the nation in growth and income. It's just the last 4 years under this regime of no public investment that has led to us dipping to 46th in income. That's the facts. And the myth that somehow investment in public goods hurts the economy, it's a myth. It's just absolutely wrong. Strategic investments for the good of the future of our workforce is what this is about, and that's what we need to do. Let's vote.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. Would anybody else like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Chair, I've been listening carefully to this macroeconomic discussion, and I suppose if we took 100% of our salaries and taxed it, we'd have great government programs, but it would only last 1 year. There wouldn't be any money to pay for the next year. We can talk about this regime of not investing in the public sector, and I think that's a false assumption, especially when you look at the increases that we've seen in some of the more critical priority areas of our state spending. However, you have to look at the other side of it. By not taxing the public to the max, we have one of the strongest economies in the United States. The state of Minnesota has the lowest unemployment rate in the history of our state right now. And that wouldn't have happened if you keep investing.
That's not true.
And you keep, we hear countless people come before this committee talking how wonderful our state economy is. That it's diversified, that it's growing, and it has been growing tremendously in just the last few years, while we've held down that impact of government-imposed costs. So there's another side to this whole discussion that wasn't brought up, and that's the performance of this state's economy, and it's growing, and no one can deny that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Grimmer, yeah, you're right. If we taxed 100%, there wouldn't be any money for government. Everything shut down the economy. Same thing if you tax 0%. You shut down all the roads, all the prisons, all the everything. You shut down the economy. That's why we need something that's called balance. That's what we're trying to get here.
That's what we're talking about.
Senator Langseth.
Well, Mr. Chair, it was totally inaccurate that we got the lowest unemployment rate now than we've ever had. In fact, we've gotten up to about the national average, and we always used to be below. But I think the point of diminishing returns is if the percentage of our income that goes for government goes up, keeps going up, then I think you start reaching that. But what has happened is that it's been going down. It was 17.3%, now it's down to about 16.1%. And if you listen to Kodrowski and Gunyo, they say level that off at about this 16.1, and then that will bring in the kind of revenue in the future that you need. So I think the argument you're making simply isn't happening. The percentage of people's income that is there after state and local is growing slightly.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Arman.
On the price of government, we are well above the national average for the price of government in the state of Minnesota compared to other states. And I think that Senator Limmer makes an awfully good point, and we're getting awfully close to the place where we're at 100%, where it's all government-driven economic growth, and it's not private sector economic growth. As the previous testifier said, we're 46th in the nation, and that's not sustainable.
State your name, and we represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm with the Interfaculty Organization, which is the state university faculty. We would like to strongly support the bill. In fact, our board last night voted in favor of raising it, supporting raising the top tax bracket in order to reduce tuition. We believe very, very strongly that it's better to raise taxes on the wealthiest people in our state than to raise tuition on some of the least wealthy people in our state. In the last decade, we've seen substantial cuts in the income tax rates for the wealthiest people, both at the federal level and the state level. In the past decade, we've seen the tuition on state university students go up over 70%. They're going deep in debt. They are stretching out their careers. The growth that we used to see, the rapid growth, is starting to flatten off. You know, we talk about growth in state spending. I looked at the Minsky appropriation in fiscal year 2002. It was $601 million. That's how much the state provided. This past year, it was $600 million. It was $1 million less than 4 years ago. But we have 8,000 more students in Minsky, and inflation during that period of time has been 11.83%. Now, who paid for that 11.83% of inflation and that enrollment growth? The students did, because the state didn't put in its share. It got shifted over onto the students, causing their tuition to skyrocket. We think this is a fair bill. It's a progressive bill. And in terms of competitiveness, you know, one of our chief competitive edges is higher education, having a well-educated workforce. We don't have a good climate. We're not centrally located. It's a well-educated workforce. But we used to say that we were the education state. And back in the 70s and the 80s, the state paid 80% of the cost of operating our institutions. It's down to about 50% now. And Governing Magazine, you're probably familiar with Governing Magazine for state and local government officials. It's in your legislative library. You know, 4 years ago, I looked up what our per capita spending. They do a comparison of all the states. What our per capita spending in higher education is, and this is all of higher education: financial aid, public, private, University of Minnesota, and so forth. And we ranked 20th in the nation back then. And when you took into account personal income, we ranked 31st. This year, I went up and looked at the source book, what the comparison is. We're down to 30th in the nation. And when you take into account effort, you know, as a percent of personal income, we're 38th in the nation. We're now behind Mississippi. We're now behind Alabama. I don't know how we can continue to be a competitive state if we don't start reinvesting in education. And this is one of the most refreshing debates I've seen, because it's time we start thinking again about making wise expenditures that are investments that you'll get a return on in the future. So we encourage support for the bill. Thanks.
Does anybody else from the public want to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and would just like to express the Chamber's opposition to this bill. We have over 2,400 members, and over 80% of those are small businesses. Our members are concerned about the effect this will have on small businesses, particularly the competitiveness issue that this may have with our businesses in surrounding states, and it may put them at a competitive disadvantage. Minnesotans paid the fifth highest state personal income taxes per capita in 2004, and that was already at 39% above the national average. And this new rate would put us at the highest income tax rate for high-wage earners. Our members tell us that income taxes influence where people choose to live and work. Between 1995 and 2000, 100,000 more people moved into Minnesota than moved out of the state, but Minnesota had a modest net loss of income attributable to migration. This probably reflects the greater proportion of high-income households that were among the migrants. Again, for our members, taxes are the number one issue that they deal with. Raising the cost of creating higher-skilled and more highly compensated jobs sends the wrong message to employers. A higher tax rate would make it more difficult and more expensive for employers to grow those kind of jobs here and encourage them to create those jobs elsewhere. Raising the top rate would hurt small business people who report business income as personal income. This would slow their short-term growth of their business, and it would eat into their long-term investment capital. Again, we see this as a competitiveness problem. And finally, to recoup the taxes paid by one household in the top 10% of income, if that person left the state, Minnesota would have to attract 31 new households with incomes between $40,000 and $53,000 a year. So again, Mr. Chair, we're concerned about the effect this would have on our small business members. Thank you.
Mr. Dietrichs, I just got to tell you and I just disagree on this. I just don't agree. The business people that I know, I just don't agree. I just don't believe that the number one issue affecting their ability to stay in business is the personal income taxes that they pay. I just can't get there. You know, I mean, the small business people I know, I think most of them would like to have more tax liability because that's an indication they're successful, their business is doing well, they're making money. I mean, the businesses that I know of are struggling with a whole lot of other issues, and it's not their personal income tax liability. Now, maybe my district is different than Senator Scoyes or Senator Langsess, but Senator Pogemeyer?
What was it one of the great capitalists of the world said? Henry Ford? My business does well when people can afford my cars.
You know, Mr. Diedrichs, I gotta tell you, business people I know where I come from, they want to make sure that their employees make enough so they can afford send their kids off to college. You know, they want to make sure that they pay their employees enough so that they can, you know, have a nice vehicle and maybe even be fortunate enough to have a cabin at the lake. And the business people I know, I don't think their number one issue is their personal income tax liability. And maybe I don't reflect business owners all over the state, but business owners where I come from are darn good people, and they care about the people that work for them. They care about the families of the people that work for them. They care about their community, and they make a lot of contributions to their community. And I just think that they're darn good people, and I don't think their number one priority is their personal income tax liability. And maybe I'm just never going to be able to agree with the chamber on that. But Mr. Hickey?
Mr. Chair.
And you represent small businesses.
Those very people, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair,
Before we get to Mr. Hickey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't gotten to the specifics in this bill, but I've been told that the fourth tier, is that at about $135,000?
It's at $250,000 for a joint return.
So about $135,000 for an individual.
$141,000 and some change.
Taxable.
Taxable income.
Not actual income,
not
taxable.
Not household income, but taxable income after deductions.
And is that, Mr. Chair, maybe Senator, is that down from when we were looking at the fourth tier last year? I thought we were looking at 270 on an individual.
I don't remember. I don't remember what Senator Pogemiller and this committee's proposal was last year. But
yeah, and Mr. Chair, it just seems like that to me, that isn't a high-end earner anymore. And I don't know that I can agree with the fourth-tier income tax argument at $140,000. I think that's becoming more of an average income. And
Senator Johnson, counsel tells me that last year, I believe, the Senate was at $270,000 joint. So
joint.
This isn't, I mean, not much different, but slightly lower, but not much.
Mr. Chair, but the rate itself is higher than was discussed. What was the rate discussed last time?
Senator Pogemiller has, I think, consistently proposed higher rates than I have, but we'd have to go back and look. But I know the Senate has passed some higher than this in the past.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was 8.1, but
Mr. Hickey?
That's what I thought.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest business group in terms of entities with 14,000 members statewide and a significant member base in every district. And, Mr. Chairman, we do represent a lot of the people you were talking about, and certainly they're not all going to be affected. These are high-income levels. But what we're doing here is we're sending the wrong signal to the most successful people in the small business sector who likely employ the most people and, importantly, make decisions about where critical expansions occur. And to that audience, to that target audience, we're really sending the wrong signal about how we handle our fiscal affairs in this state. And we're doing it while we have a surplus. I realize the surplus is not as big as it's reported in the paper, but albeit it is a surplus. And it really sends the wrong signal to this critical target audience. As Dave mentioned, our income taxes are fifth highest per capita as using 04 data from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. And second at our 7.85% current top rate, Minnesota has the eighth highest income tax for high wage earners currently. And to go to this new top rate is not the direction this state should be moving, in our opinion. Finally, we are still fourth in total taxes per capita. And you look down the list, we're, you know, a pretty small state compared to the larger jurisdictions in this country, Massachusetts at 7, New Jersey at 8, New York down at 10, although we spend a lot of money buying people's property taxes down and doing things that other states don't do, or they don't do it to our extent. Currently, we're spending 9% of the general fund budget on local property tax aids credits, so we're doing some different things, but that number stays high. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, we didn't agree with Governor Perpich on too many things, and I realize you weren't around then. I was a rookie lobbyist back then, but the one thing that we did agree with him on is he did not want Minnesota to increase, he wanted to reduce, actually, Minnesota income tax rates. And he wanted to get Minnesota, I don't know if he wanted to get us out of the top 10, but he wanted to get us out of the top couple. And that was the one thing we did agree with him. And with this proposal, where we're moving up the ladder in the wrong way. And former Governor Perpich was real concerned about the impressions our tax code left with entrepreneurs, and he talked about it a lot. And so that was one thing we agreed with him on, and urge you not to proceed with this.
Any questions? Sir Moi.
Mr. Hickey, do you think your members worry that at some point they won't be able to find a workforce who will be able to sustain their business?
Senator Moi, yeah, they've got a lot of concerns about the level of education they perceive in employees they're bringing in the door. And I think they have a real great concerns about the whole educational system, you know, and they see it when those people come through the door for those first jobs in a small business.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemon.
I've been reminded by Senator Wieger that at the legislative retreat in early January at the U of M, business panel leaders said the number one issue challenge for business was the workforce. The number one issue for the business leaders was workforce. This bill invests in the workforce of the future.
Thank you. Would anybody else like to testify? Senator Stump's bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I have those slides from Mr. Sims' presentations, and one that jumps out to me. It says, over the last decade, there was no difference in average growth in the most top 10, quote, business tax friendly in the 10, quote, least friendly states, according to how the business community describes states.
Senator Pogamilla renews his motion that Senate File 1611, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Probably. Well, there's a dip.